This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This segment is brought to you by Larson & Larson for all your questions about protecting your intellectual property. They are my lawyers. Make them yours. Now, coming to my guest. I have to admit that I'm in love with my next guest, or at least I'm in love with his brain, because it is a simply amazing brain, and it belongs to one of the most prolific writers. He's written millions and millions and millions of words, and the best thing about it is he gets paid for it, and that's Mike Resnick. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Patsy. How are you doing?
Okay, great. Oh, it's so good to talk to you. You know, I think about your brain all the time because it is an amazing brain.
Well, thank you. I almost never think about my brain.
Well, I do because, you know, it's something special. Not many people have so many various ideas in their mind. You know, Hercule Poirot had his gray cells, but I have a feeling that if we looked at your cells, brain cells, they'd be like all psychedelic colors because they're like you have such a depth of knowledge about so many subjects, and your writing is so fluid and so natural. It's just beautiful how you bring in all of these different subjects that you're interested in.
Well, I'm very flattered that you say so. Actually, most of my brain cells are usually snoring till about mid-afternoon.
Well, when they wake up, they really work. Because, you know, I was trying to think about you know, of course, you're famous for your science fiction, but I also love—I just love your mystery stories. And I really, when I was talking to Carolyn Hart recently, it reminded me of—I think it's one of my favorite mystery stories, and that's The Dog in the Manger, which is, I think, absolutely brilliant.
Well, thank you very much. They became kind of. Each one had a different animal as at the core of the mystery. The second book in that series was The Trojan Colt, about the yearling sales in Keeneland. And the third, which came out last year, I think it was Cat on a Cold Tin Roof.
Well,
cat's collar, not the cat itself, is the key to the mystery.
Well, of course, your detective is a PI, a former Chicago police officer, and you know, in some ways, one would think, well, that's been done, but not the way you do it. Your hero is a very special guy. Tell us a little bit. How did you come up with this?
Well, I figured not everybody really knows or applies modern police methods if they're working alone as detectives. And, for example, to this day, I don't have a cell phone. I think there ought to be times nobody can bother me. And for that reason, my detective doesn't have one.
And his name is...
I don't have a global positioning device on my car. I find them annoying. So he doesn't have one and frequently goes to the wrong address and so forth. But he's a bright guy, and he works his way through.
And his name is Eli Paxton.
Yeah.
And... it's written with so much humor that sometimes you're reading mystery, but you're laughing your head off sometimes too.
I try to put it in. Every time you put in a little humor in a tense scene, you can extend that scene. Otherwise, it would get pretty boring.
And
so I have a humor, bits of humor in a lot of my books and stories.
Well, every time I hear about the Westminster Dog Show, I think about you, because I had never understood the dog show business until I read your book.
My wife and I bred and exhibited collies years ago. We had 23 different champions that we bred and exhibited, And in fact, the whole reason we're in Cincinnati is because we bought the second biggest boarding and grooming kennel in the country, and it happened to be here. So we moved here from Chicago. And the reason we had to buy it, since we're talking about my writing, was like most writers, I wasn't prepared to do brilliant stuff when I was 22 or 23, but I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I got my start in what I call that other field, the one where we all wrote under pseudonyms so nobody would know who we were. These days, I think they call it the adult field. And I did a couple of hundred books under pseudonyms, and one day I walked up to my wife and said, you know, if I do one more four-day book or six-hour screenplay, my brain's going to turn to putty and run out my ear. What else do we know how to do? And we figure, well, we're caring for 15, 18 dogs. We know how to do that. Let's look for a kennel. And that's how I wound up in Cincinnati. I got out of the other field and into the field I like.
Well, it's in the book, of course, Dog in the Manger, you explain the whole sort of, I had always thought, you know, they made a fortune at these dog shows. And I thought, oh, well, they're making $1 million every time they show a dog. And
no, so, we're not talking, you know, racehorses here. American Pharoah can make $8 million in a year. Best in Show at Westminster gets you a 30-cent piece of ribbon.
Oh, wow. Well, it puts it in perspective. Perspective, and it's fun to know the background of the whole sort of world of dog shows. I mean that's just part of the story, and the actual story is so exciting. I can't tell people how, you know, it's one of the few mysteries where I was just tied to it, you know, page after page. I didn't know what was going to happen, and it's a fantastic book. And
well, you're my kind of audience. I must say, I'm not going to be doing any more mysteries for a few years. I seem to be contracted ahead for at least the next 3 years on science fiction.
Well,
one of these days I'll get back.
Yeah, you have to get back because you know, Eli Paxton's an interesting character. Well, all of your characters are always interesting, but he's particularly, I find him very, very pleasant to read, and I could read Eli Paxton every month. So I think you did a great job, and I love the Trojan.
An exceptionally wealthy publisher who felt like that.
You know, of course we have to talk about you know, your awards. I don't even know where to start. I said to you in an email that I can't even start to list all of your awards. I don't know if you must have like a special, you know, you had to build a little house. You have like more awards than anybody.
Well, I have more awards for short fiction than any science fiction writer who's ever lived. When you add in novels, I come in, I think, fourth.
Yeah, I think so. Pretty high up there. And of course, they're all just amazing, you know, what you've managed to do. Oh, it's mind-boggling. And I know for writers who are saying, well, you know, are awards important? Of course, awards are important because that gets you published. That gets you, you know, better contracts all the time.
One of the things that it really does is it helps you sell overseas. If two stories come onto an editor's desk and he barely speaks English, frequently it's enough to know that this story won an award, that one didn't. Easy call on which one to buy.
And of course, you're published in so many countries. It's amazing. I know that, you know, I'm a youper from the Michigan's Upper Peninsula. So I was very happy to see that you're even published in Finland.
So. I think I've been in 26 languages. I don't know how many countries, more than that, clearly. Part of it is having a very, very good agent who has wonderful foreign contacts. And the other part, as I say, is, you know, winning enough awards so they start paying attention to you. And my average story probably sells to a dozen different countries. It's not generally known, but if you talk to any journeyman writer, what he'll tell you is he doesn't make more in any other country than he makes from the United States, but he almost certainly makes more from the rest of the world than he makes from the United States.
Yeah, you're right. Most people don't realize that.
Well, for example, I have a novel called Santiago. I just sold it again. This time, I think it was to the... it's to Italy. And that's its 22nd sale. Only one of them has been to America.
Wow.
The American sale was for more money than any of the other 21, but you put 21 of them together, it comes to a lot more than I made out of this country.
So that's, it's a good deal. That works out nicely.
Yeah, and, this has been going on for quite some time. The rest of the world's just as interested in science fiction and in mysteries and everything else as we are. And the trick is for a journeyman writer to be able to figure out how to get your stuff seen by them.
And, of course, with your experience as an editor, that's one of the things that you've done besides, you know, writing so many books. I don't even know how many books now. It must be, 70 books? 70 novels?
70 books that I signed my name to, yeah.
Yeah, 70 novels, I think, or more.
Yeah, and about 280 short stories, something like that, a couple of screenplays. And I've also done a lot of editing. Yeah, I've edited 42 anthologies. I'm currently editing a magazine called Galaxy's Edge, and I'm editing a line of books called Stellar Guild.
And I know that you won the Jovian Award last year for Best Editor.
Yeah. So yeah, I was. That was very pleasant because that was only our magazine's second year of business.
And as you said, you know, all over the world, people are interested in science fiction, and I don't see a decline in that coming because it's just a wonderful field. And
no, I think the biggest declines you're going to see, and nobody knows where it's going to lead to, are e-books. Any book title of mine you name is probably on 15 pirate sites as much as I keep after them. And it doesn't cost a publisher as much to make an e-book, so you don't sell it for as much, so of course the royalties are less. Nobody's quite sure what's going to happen with them. I know that, you know, Borders went out of business. That took away about 1,000 bookstores from the United States. Barnes, I know, is not doing as well as it did. And I attribute a lot of it to just the change in technology.
Now, when you find that your books are pirated, you go after them?
Oh, sure.
Yeah? You have a good lawyer?
Yeah.
I think,
I heard that you do, too.
Yes, I do, because now, of course, you're much more experienced with Hollywood than I am. Well,
Hollywood would drive you crazy.
It did. And I know that without a good lawyer, your life can be a real mess. So it's very important that writers have to have a good lawyer.
And in fact, in Hollywood, you don't need an agent, you need a lawyer.
Exactly.
All an agent does is put you together with somebody for lunch. The lawyer, the second you get an offer, even if it comes to your agent, it goes right to his lawyer or your lawyer.
And of course, as you said, you've written screenplays, but they're not your favorite.
They drive you crazy. First thing that happens when you meet a producer who has optioned your book is he opens his arms wide to hug you and says, "Booby," that's all anybody calls you out there, "Booby, I love your work. I've read a synopsis of every book you've written." And then you'll sit around in the story conference with five or six guys. You're the screenwriter, so of course you're the only one who doesn't have script approval. And one of these guys, who are all making $700,000-$800,000 a year, looks up and says, "Well, why can't one of the twins be black?" And that's about the brightest question you get all day.
I've experienced that, and it does drive you crazy. So
it really does. I know that when Pride and Prejudice was remade about 3 years ago, it leaked out that one of these jerks actually wondered if they could have an author tour.
Yeah, well, that sounds about right to me. Well, that's like I was working with one group of these very young and very high paid producers or whatever they want to be called, and they weren't sure exactly when Vietnam War was. And since my story is about the Vietnam War, it was really difficult to get it through their heads.
Yeah, it drives you crazy. The only thing that keeps us going back is saying, you know, they play with Monopoly money.
Yeah, well, that's true. And of course, no, I think, as a matter of fact, your mystery series, I think, was optioned, right? Because
I believe the first one was optioned, but then the option lapsed. So right now they're not under option.
Okay. Well, I have a few people in Hollywood who are listen to my program because I also interview agents, and I'm telling them they should really. I would love to work on this script for Eli Paxton because
you get somebody to buy him, and I'd be happy to have you.
That's what I would love to, because I really feel like I know him. I just every time I think about that. That trip to Mexico, I just love it.
I'll tell you, there's one real easy thing that the e-books have made possible. If I were to say, you know, do you want to read the other two books about Eli Paxton, and you say yes, I don't have to go hunt up copies, go to the post office, and spend money mailing them. I can just email them to you, like, in 20 seconds.
Yeah, no, that is wonderful. That is the greatest thing about, you know, being able to go back and get books that, you know, are out of print.
Oh, yeah. It's not even just books that are out of print. I went blind in one eye about 9 years ago. The other eye, you know, it sees well enough so I don't walk into walls or anything, but it's a little more difficult to read. But I find that with a Nook or a Kindle, I have a Nook, I can make the background as light as I want. I can make the type bigger or smaller. I have no problem reading off one of those machines. And the beauty of it is when we would go on a week's vacation or go to a convention or something, we would pick up 8 or 9 beat-up paperbacks in the local book nook and just leave them behind as we finished them. Right now, my Nook has 3,400 books on it, and it weighs 14 ounces, and it's not half full.
I know. Isn't it amazing? It is amazing. I love
it. Just amazed by it.
I love it. Now, you know, we have quite a few things in common, besides the fact that both of us, I think, read like 5 books a week.
At least.
And ever since I started this show, I get from publishers like 2 or 3 books a day. So I'm really like, woo.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
But we were both born in March.
Yep.
And we were both fencers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you fenced when you were young. You gave it up?
Yeah, I gave it up, but I fenced in college. I won 3 letters.
I know.
For 2 weeks. 2 weeks total, I was nationally ranked. Then I got beat again.
Well, you know, I gave it up too, and now I'm thinking about going back because it really is a wonderful discipline.
I'll tell you one thing that it inhibits. It inhibits your ability to write a real exciting sword fight because you know better.
That's true. but it is a nice discipline and it's fun. So I'm thinking about going back to that, and then maybe I'll go to Hollywood, and then maybe I'll do some fencing with some of these people who don't understand that an F-105 airplane was in Vietnam, and like, and where is Vietnam? So, you know, I these people drive me crazy.
Oh, that brings back memories of Hollywood. Yes, indeed.
So we're born in March, we fence, and of course we both have this deep feeling for Africa. I started when I was very young. I was absolutely taken with trying to understand Africa, and I wanted to go and work in Africa. So I got a job as a candy striper in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And just so I could, in the evenings, read all the books on medicine and diseases in Africa. So that's where sort of my interest started when I was very young. And what first took you to Africa?
Probably a number of books I'd read about African animals and Africa in general. Also, now as I grew up and became a science fiction writer, it's phenomenal background material. You know, we're trying, for example, to create an alien society. Africa gives you 51 distinct examples of pretty alien society. Take Kenya, which is pro-Western, pro-capitalist, and has its own metropolis, Nairobi, about 3 million people. And yet, of the 43 languages in Kenya, not one of them had a word for wheel as recently as 1900. Now, you can't get much more alien than that.
That's true. And, of course, one of your greatest books, and one that you won the Hugo Award for, is set in, well, around this entire Kenya society. Of course, it's called Kirinyaga.
Ah, Kirinyaga is the...
It's an amazing book.
Kikuyu name for Mount Kenya, which is where their god lives.
And tell us a little bit about this book, because it is really quite amazing. Of course, you won Hugo for that. And
I won Hugos for two of the stories in
it.
The book itself has won awards, but it wasn't eligible for Hugo because it had already won some.
Yeah.
Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game, was doing an anthology in 1986, and he asked me if I would be willing to write a story for it. And I said, sure, and what was it about? The title of it was Utopia, spelled E-U-T-O-P-I-A, and he postulated a number of artificial planetoids, each of which was open to immigration from a group trying to build a utopian society. And he had, you know, communist planetoids and thinking shark or thinking dolphin planetoids and just about every group you could think of. And I told him I would choose East Africa because I'd just been there a few times. And I chose the Kikuyu people. And he had a couple of catch-22s that made it very interesting. One of them was that it had to be told by an insider who believed in it, not a wonder tour from some tourist. And the other was that if you didn't like it, you could walk to a certain spot, and a ship would pick you up and take you away within an hour. So there would be no revolts against Big Brother. And I thought that made it very interesting. And for the first story, which won the first Hugo I ever got, I tried to think of their, what I consider their most heinous cultural tradition, and write a story defending it, since this is supposed to be a Kikuyu utopia, not a Western one. And that tradition is that any baby born feet first must be a devil and must be put to death instantly. And I had my narrator defend that passionately and logically. It's not anything I believe in, but he believed in it. And as I say, it won an award. And the second story, again, he's trying to uphold traditions as he gets a brilliant little girl who wants to learn how to read. And when he won't teach her, she even sneaks into his computer, the only computer on the planetoid, and teaches herself. But in Kikuyu tradition, women don't read. And bit by bit, his utopia falls apart because, you can't continually stifle every modern instinct. But that was what the story, the book was about.
And, of course, with your experience of, you have a lot of opinion on colonialism and what it's done over the years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So. And I especially, we've been to Africa like half a dozen times, on long trips, and I especially like East Africa, and you can't go there too many times without learning a little bit about it.
Yeah.
For example, there's a word that I heard our private guide use, Manamuki. And I said, what the hell does that mean? And he said, oh, wife. Well, no, I looked it up. It doesn't mean wife. It means female property, and it applies in this very sexist society to women, sows, bitches, mares. And I wrote a story called The Manamuki, and that also won a Hugo.
Won a Hugo. I know. And well, I don't know. There's still a lot of people in America who believe Manamuki.
You don't have to. By the way, I should also add that Orson Scott Card's anthology never came out. Thank goodness he let me sell it somewhere else.
Well, this is just the start. You were saying that we... You thought a whole hour interview was too long, but I'm just starting. And what I need to do is take a commercial break so that I can afford to keep you on. Okay? So hold on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. On January 30th, when best-selling author Tim Dorsey will be signing autographs of his latest adventure, Coconut Cowboy. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg. And they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, Mike Resnick, who has written so many books that it's difficult to even begin to talk about them. Now, what I love about Mike, and Mike, when I think about you and I think about your great brain, I wish I was Raquel Welch in Fantastic Voyage. You know how she gets into that tiny submarine, and I'd like to just be injected into your head and, you know, float around in there. It must be like a...
you'd probably find it pretty messy.
No, it'd be like a Disney World and a circus and an encyclopedia all rolled into one, because you have such a wide depth of knowledge, you know, and you can go from subject to subject so easily. And, of course, as you said, you've been reading, at least 300 books a year, so...
Well, the trick is, you know, as you're reading or listening, just... Try to find ideas that other people overlook. I don't read Scientific American. My knowledge of science probably equivalent to a 7-year-old kid who's yet to go to school. But for example, a good example. My daughter, who by the way is an award-winning science fiction writer these days, but when she was about 9 or 10, I took her to her first James Bond film. And she came home wildly impressed and started karateing all the furniture, just like Roger Moore was doing. And she managed to bust an antique chair. So I looked around in the phone book. This was up in Illinois where we lived. And I brought it to the nearest repair shop, dropped it off. And I go back about 3 days later to pick it up. And it turns out that the repairman is a little old Jewish man, a Hasidic Jew. And he worked in a prayer shawl and a yarmulke and what have you. And when he saw I had a Jewish last name, nothing would do but that he lectured me on the error of my ways. I'm not aware of which error came to his attention, but he goes on and on and on, and all I want to do is pay for my chair and get it home. And finally, at one point, I recognized the word for Messiah, and I said, well, you know, hopefully he'll show up next week. You can, you know, have a nice chat with him, and can I have my chair, please? And he turns white as a sheet and explains that the Messiah that the Jews are waiting for isn't the Prince of Peace, that he's going to burn every other kingdom to the ground before he builds his own kingdom in Jerusalem. And I, at that point, had never read the Bible beyond Exodus, but I went home and I read it that night, and son of a gun, I sat down the next day to write a book about the true Jewish Messiah who shows up 50 years from now, and we're not real happy to see him. And, you know, you don't have to research these things that much. You just have to be alert to what people are saying, to ideas that are laying there waiting to be written.
Well, you know, I didn't open the show to callers, but I do have a fan who wants to ask you a question, and so she's called in, and I'm going to let her get on because, as I said, she's a fan, I'm a fan, and I'm interested in hearing her question.
Sure.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, Patsy. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hi, Mr. Resnick.
Hi.
It's an honor to speak to you. So as Patsy was saying, I go by Katie Price. That's my writing name. I'm a new science fiction writer, writing my first book, and I just really wanted to just probe your brain. As Patsy said, you have such a marvelous brain, and I just wanted to probe you for some insight on how you approach different topics. It's been a pleasure to read your works. I just finished A Lady with an Alien, and it was so enjoyable, very funny, and I wondered what percentage of time you spent researching Leonardo da Vinci versus writing Lady with an Alien.
Tell you a story about that. I should explain to you, the audience. I did a book in called The Dark Lady. It won some huge award in France, and the narrator is an alien art critic, and his name they can't pronounce it, so they call him Leonardo. And when a new company opened up, Watson Guptill was the name of the publisher. They did $80 coffee table books on art, and they realized their audience was getting old and dying off. They had to get some kids interested, so they started a line called Art Encounters, which each was a novel about the creation of a particular work of art. And my agent sent them The Dark Lady just because it was my most recent book, and they could see that I knew how to write. And they thought she was sending me as an expert on Leonardo, so I had to write a book about one of Leonardo's creations. That was the only thing they would buy from me, so I had to study him a little bit.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. What made you choose Lady with an Ermine as the focal point of the book versus all of the other works that Leonardo da Vinci had?
Lady with an Alien, he only had about 12 paintings survive. I mean, we think of Picasso, we think of, you know, 1,000 paintings out there, but only about 10 or 12 of Leonardo's survived. And all I did was I looked through them all and, you know, trying to get an idea which one I would write about. And none of the others really lent themselves to any kind of a science fiction story, but Lady with an Ermine, that Ermine doesn't look like any Ermine I ever saw. So I thought, well, Lady with an Alien, now I've got a story. I just have to figure out what she's doing with it and how it got there.
Well, it is one of my favorite books, and thank you, KD, so much for asking that question, because I think it's one of, really, a fantastic book and a wonderful way to learn history by the enormous research that you did put into it, because it reads so beautifully.
Well, I thank you. I did two others for that company. I did one on the Moulin Rouge poster that Toulouse-Lautrec did, and one on a Salvador Dali painting. And there was one I was having a wonderful time researching when they decided to kill the line, and that was Remington, the cowboy artist. Well, he hated the West. He hated Indians and cowboys. He hated the outdoors. Almost all his Western stuff was done in his studio in Upper New York State. And he also weighed about 400 pounds. Teddy Roosevelt loved this painting and had him join the Rough Riders. And on the day that they stormed San Juan Hill, this guy had overeaten and was sick in his tent. But they described it to him, and the painting he did, based only on the description, nothing firsthand, is hanging in the White House. And I wasn't able to write that because they killed the line.
Well, you know, when we're talking about historical works like these particular books that you did, I love when that you've made this available for people to read, you know, to learn history in a fun way.
Well, there has to be, you know, editors and publishers who want it.
Now, KD, thank you so much for calling in. Are you there?
Thank you, Patsy.
Okay,
yes,
well,
I'm here.
Thank you, and I'm hopeful that you finish your work, and we look forward to seeing it.
Thank you both so much.
Okay, thanks, KD. And you know, Mike, as I was saying, when the first time I read Lady with the Ermine, and then of course the Salvador Dali, you know, we have the best Salvador Dali museum, well, one of
I've
the best
there.
Right here.
Oh, yes, I've been there. I love that.
Well, they've redone it. I don't know when you were here.
I think it was about most recently, about 7 years ago.
Okay, so the new one is open, and it is really quite amazing. It really is worthy of his works. So you have to come back down here to Florida and see it.
I get down there every couple of years. I'm sure I will see it next time.
Well, as a matter of fact, you have some connection with Tampa University?
Yeah, there was a time when we thought we were going to be moving into that area. Turns out we didn't, but I was looking for some college to stash all my papers. Almost every writer does that at some point. And Tampa, the University of South Florida, I think it's called. They have a special collection there. They have not only my stuff, but science fiction writer Piers Anthony's and a few other writers. I think they got 127 boxes of my stuff.
Whoa.
You know, manuscripts, contracts, whatever. Every time a new book comes out, I autograph it and send it there, so they should have all my books.
Well, that's great. You have to come down here, and then you can come to the studio so we can do an in-person interview.
I'd love to.
Oh, because as I said, one, because you can see your collection at USF, which is a great school, and the new Salvador Dali Museum, which is truly amazing. I was going to ask you about a few other writers. You know, did you ever work with Harry Bates?
No, he way predates
me. Predates you. I wasn't sure if...
He was through editing before I was born, and I was born 73 years ago.
Well, no, I thought he was still around. Nope, okay. Now, of course, you went to the University of Chicago, but that was around the time of Saul Bellow. Did you ever meet him?
No, I didn't. The University of Chicago loved to brag about how many Nobel Prize winners they had on their staff, but most of them taught like 1 hour a week. I mean, Chicago was just paying them to get their names.
So he was never. No, I think probably he was just not teaching, more exactly doing what you said. He was lending his name to the institution.
Yeah, he was busy writing Herzog and a bunch of other stuff and lending his name.
And when you were editing, well, the different magazines, you've edited quite a few. You discovered quite a few young writers.
Yeah, I feel that this field has been so good to me for a quite a long lifetime that the way I thank it is by paying ahead and helping. Everybody who helped me is either rich or dead or both. So the way I help is by paying forward. And I've got about 15 or 20 people that are known informally as my writer children. And when I find a good one, I'll collaborate with them to get them into print. I'll buy from them for my magazine or for the anthologies I write at convention, or I edit, mean. And at conventions, I'll take them around, introduce them to agents and other editors. And some of them have gone on and done very nice things. It makes me very, very pleased.
Well, I think it's a wonderful thing to do. And KD called in, and KD was, I had met her at a writer's conference, and she was just one of these enthusiastic young people, you know, really excited. And I was very pleased that she had read your book, and was interested in talking to you.
Oh, I'm very flattered. And, of course, the flip side of this, or the important thing is, helping others doesn't hurt, which is to say, if they go out and wind up number one on the New York Times bestseller list, it doesn't cost me a single sale for having helped them. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah, exactly, and it makes you feel good, and and maybe if you like the book, your blurb is on it, and so that's always nice to see.
Right, maybe someday when I'm starving in my dotage, one of them will be an editor, and they'll buy.
No, I don't think so. When you do decide to take a summer home, you have to come down here to Clearwater, Florida. as the mayor was on my program recently, and he was saying, you know, you have to always tell everybody that the weather is perfect here in Clearwater for writers. So we're encouraging writers to come down
here. Well, one of the things I find as a writer is I have no idea what it's doing outside. I never open my blinds, and I stay in my room and work.
And, I know the feeling. My office overlooks the intercoastal waterways, and it's so beautiful that I do find myself drifting over there looking. But I start so early in the morning. I try to start like at 4:35, and so it's still dark, and so nothing distracts me.
Well, that's what I've been doing for half a century. I sit down to work at 10 at night, and I knock off at about 5 or 6 in the morning because nobody rings the phone or knocks on the door during those hours.
Yeah, well, that's the nice thing about being a writer. You can choose your hours, and especially when we get to the point that you've gotten to, where you've written so many millions of words and so many things. So it's just fantastic.
You gotta love what you're doing. So many writers hate writing and love having written. Me, I love writing. That's the difference between, I don't know, being prolific and not.
And being happy or not. Because I cannot stand when a writer says, oh, it's such a pain. Oh, it's so hard for me. I have to, you know.
I don't sympathize with suffering artists.
No, I don't either. Because the name of the program is Joy on Paper. And it is such a joy. It is such
a
joy.
These days it's probably joy in phosphorus.
Well, but, you know, to get your words down, to see them down, and, of course, hopefully to sell them, but just to get them down and to have that feeling of satisfaction is something that until you experience it, you really don't understand how wonderful it is.
Yeah.
And, of course, being able to create character. Well, you create so many characters. Oh, I mean, we can't even begin.
My kick doesn't come from seeing my name in print. My kick comes at the end of the workday when I read what I've written, and it's pretty much what I had hoped that it would be when I sat down 7 or 8 hours ago.
Well, that's what makes for a happy person, I think. You have to have that attitude that the work gives you the joy, and then, of course, if you get paid for it, that gives you a double joy.
Yeah, it feels like stealing. It really does.
Oh, well, you've been stealing a lot because you're selling everything. I mean, when few people have written as much as you and gotten paid for it, so it's... Must make you feel pretty good.
Well, yeah, I think most writers live in the absolute fear that publishers one of these days will figure out that, you know, if they stop paying us, we'd do it for free, and if they still wouldn't take it, we'd pay them.
That's true. You have to worry about. You never know what's in their minds, to tell you the truth. Yeah.
Oh, you don't, but you can be sure it's pretty mercenary.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today. As I said, I just marvel at your work, marvel at your your mind. And
well, you know, maybe I can do you a real quick favor. Do you have a Nook or a Kindle?
Well, yeah, I would.
Which?
I have a Kindle.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll email you the other two Eli Paxton books later.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, what I really need is an autographed copy, and that's what I
can't do.
But
next time I'm in Clearwater, we'll get together. I'll autograph.
Absolutely.
You know, a book and a luncheon check.
Well, I'll take that too. But I have a whole big pile of your books, so you're gonna have to be really, really energetic that day to keep signing them. I think I must have at least. Well, I don't have all 70. But I have a goodly number.
Well, so. Actually, this is going to sound hard to believe, but it's far more than 70. It's 70 novels. I've got 20 odd collections, 40 odd anthologies.
Yeah,
it takes up a lot of room.
It does. Well, actually, at the rate I'm going to, you're going to fill up one of my shelves, and I have a few thousand books myself. So,
you're my kind of reader.
Well, I still like the feeling of a book in my hand. I know. I mean, I love Kindle, and I love, you know, to be able to read late at night and to have the backlight on and stuff. But I still love the feeling of a book. I have so many very old books and antique books, and you just, there's nothing quite like
it.
Well,
once I went blind in one eye, I found out that I can read much more easily, in a Kindle or a Nook. So every time I add one that we already had in paper, I sell the paper one on eBay.
Okay.
I think we had something like 6,000 books to start. We're down to about 3,000 now.
Yeah, I'm down to about 3,000 too. That's we moved from a house, a large house, to a condo, and so I had to.
Leah had to do it.
I had to do some, but it was hard. And mostly, what I landed up throwing out were old textbooks, school books, and it's a hard thing to do when you like to read. So, anyway, I want to thank you again. There's so many books I wanted to talk. Well, I want to say about one of your characters that I love, the novel, Lucifer Jones.
He's my favorite.
Well,
what happened was one day, this must be 35 years ago, I was trading videotapes with somebody, and back then we had a Beta machine, and that was only good for 2 hours. And there was a movie called She with Ursula Le Guin. Ursula Andress, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I was trading with wanted it, and since the movie itself was like an hour and 58 minutes, I realized I was going to have to stay there and cut out the commercials. I couldn't just put on a videotape because it wouldn't have enough time. And my wife came down in about 15 minutes, kind of annoyed that I was clearly watching a Marx Brothers festival or something, laughing my head off, and I hadn't told her. And I was saying, no, I was watching the worst movie ever made, and if they could be that funny by accident, maybe I should be that funny on purpose. And that was the inspiration for Lucifer Jones. He is a parody of every bad pulp story and B-movie ever written or made. And I'm just finishing the fifth Lucifer Jones book this week. They've been spread out over about 25 years because just every time I need to feel good and laugh, I sit down and write one of the stories.
Well, your fans will be happy to hear that. I didn't know you were working on one, so that's fantastic news.
Well, at the end, each one is set on a different continent. At the end of each book, he's kicked off that continent forever. And he's still got a continent to go.
I will look forward to that one because as I said, it's your favorite. You said it's your favorite character. It's probably my favorite character. Besides, I just took a love to Eli Paxton. He's at the top of my list.
Well, I'll do a little something about
that. Yeah, you have to write another one. And and you can dedicate it to me, because I bet.
Why not? You got the next Eli Paxton book, whenever that is.
That's a good idea, because I dare say you've dedicated enough to your wife, right?
Oh, she gets part of every dedication.
I bet she does.
I think she's had more than 100.
Well, you've been married to a few years?
53, right.
Yeah. You should try to remember that. Well, she's a lucky woman. She gets to look across.
No, I'm the lucky one.
Well,
she's perfect.
And well, she gets to live with the great brain. And so that's pretty good. So
her brain is considerably better than mine, believe me.
Well, it's good that you have a wonderful, cheerful nature. I think that comes across in your books. And I just can't recommend them more highly. Everybody should go to your website. Is what?
My website is www.mikeresnick.com. And I'm also on Facebook. And if you just want an endless list of all the stuff I've written, just hunt me up on Wikipedia.
Yes. And
I do try and keep them updated.
And, of course, the books are available on Amazon. And so you
Amazon,
can go,
Barnes, and Kobo,
all of the other ones.
You name it.
And you can go back, and if you're interested in one of the series, you can go back and start right from the beginning and go through. But most of the books, like the Eli Paxton ones, are standalone, and if you can read one, and you can read all three of them.
And, if you have a Nook or a Kindle, a number of them are available in electric form on my webpage, so we can cut the publisher out of it.
Oh, but, good idea.
Whatever.
Good idea. Go directly to Mike's webpage, www.mikeresnick.com, and get one of the Kindle books now, because you will really enjoy it.
Right. So if enough of you do it, then when I pay for lunch with Patsy, it won't bounce.
That sounds good to me. Okay. Thanks again, Mike.
Okay. My pleasure.
Keep warm up there, okay?
We're doing our best.
Okay. Take care.
Okay.
Thanks
Bye.
A lot. Bye-bye now.
Yep.
Wow. That was wonderful. That's like a dream come true to be able to talk to Mike. So I want to say I have a few minutes. Again, if you're tired of being stuck in the house and you want to get out for an evening and you don't really want to spend big bucks on a big dinner that you probably don't need, treat yourself to a wine tasting at Miami Avenue Wine Bar. It's a really lovely place, and there's live music every Friday and Saturday night. And it's Miami Avenue Wine Bar, located just off Gulf Boulevard in Indian Rocks Road. Not Indian Rocks Road, Indian Rocks Beach, I'm sorry. And it's called, as I said, Miami Avenue Wine Bar. It's for fun, and it's a great place to meet up with friends. So do go there this weekend. And also, if you need any help with your intellectual property, call Larson & Larson. Meanwhile, this is Patsy with a Z, wishing you a great week. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Oh, no, don't. Join me Thursday, 2 days from now, because I've got some really great guests coming. 3 guests in the studio, and it's going to be lots of fun. So join me Thursday at 11 a.m. Meanwhile, remember, just find your joy and treasure it and share it. See you on Thursday. Bye.